Those teams were not good. They were in transition phases, and they didn't draft well before Stan got there. At the end of the day, you can point fingers at X, Y, Z, W, B, C, D, but like the team hasn't drafted well, and that's why they're in the predicament that they're in.
What's up, guys? Welcome to Birdwatch. I'm Christian Clark, the Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com and The Advocate. Here on Monday morning, we've had a few days to digest the Stan Van Gundy hiring. I wanted to bring James Edwards, III of The Athletic, on to give a little perspective on what it's like to cover SVG. He is the Pistons beat writer for The Athletic. How long have you been with him now, James?
I always go by how long has Luke Kennard been in the league? This will be Luke Kennard's fourth year whenever next season starts. So I did two with Casey and one with Stan. So I technically finished three, I guess, if we count this season as finished in March. Three going on four is the correct number.
Nice. So you got the last year of SVG's run in Detroit.
Yeah. Yep. The last one. A crazy year for a first-year NBA beat writer. Obviously, his job was on the line as team president and coach. The Blake Griffin trade happens in... I wrote about that story. I did a story on my first year covering the beat, and it was like late January, early February or something like that. And my buddy had come into town, and I had an off day, and we were going to the casino, and we had to turn around because Blake Griffin got traded to the Pistons.
So you thought you were going to play some blackjack, and then you're going home to write 1,500 words on Blake Griffin's coming to Detroit.
Yeah, and I'm just like, what? I don't even, my sourcing isn't as great as it should be. It was just something that I just didn't expect. But yeah, we're here now. We're wiser. We're smarter. And something like that will not happen again.
Yeah, as someone who's still pretty new to doing this full time, I live in fear of that. Just like a crazy trade that, wasn't on my radar at all, and I'm scrambling. But that's the life of a beat writer, I guess. We're going to talk plenty of Stan, but I guess first, there's a chance that we're covering games again in 2020. In the last few days, it seems like, things have shifted to the point where they're sort of realizing that, there's probably not going to be a vaccine developed, and I don't want to say they're punting on 2020, 2021, but they're realizing that, hey, this year probably isn't going to be great no matter what we do. Let's just, get back to where we're ending the season in the middle part of the summer and we're not going into the dog days as much. What do you think about this potential 72-game season, start somewhere around Christmas and go into June sort of as we're accustomed? Are you ready to be back in it sooner rather than later, or do you think we will be?
Well, first of all, I got super excited when the NBA said they want to be done. They want to get back to their normal calendar because there was a fear that they were going to try to switch up the calendar and do all this. And as you know, Christian, I mean, at least maybe you're not as lazy as me, but I love being on the teacher schedule where we're off in the summers. And I cover the Pistons, so I'm off every summer from late April until October. That excited me. Yeah, I don't think they're going to play this year. I just, if I'm not mistaken, it has to be run by and agreed upon by the NBPA, and I just can't see the players after what they just went through, especially those who had long stays in the bubble, wanting to be in camp in a month and a half. I think still MLK Day is probably the best time. I don't know if there's a certain number of games that have to be played in terms of TV contracts and stuff like that, so I don't know if you can start late January and maybe only play 60 games or 65. But I still think they're going to start in January and squeeze in 70 at the most, 72, whatever it is. I just can't see it starting this year. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I just can't see the players going for that.
Yeah, I mean, if they did do that, I think that would give the Lakers something 7 weeks off between, the last day of the finals and when they would have to report to training camp. I mean, that's a pretty insane turnaround, and it's hard to imagine LeBron is really enthusiastic for that or anything like that. So yeah, I would say that's a little bit ambitious. I threw that date at a couple people in the Pels front office on Friday, and that was mostly the response I got back was ambitious. But yeah, I'm with you. I think January would make the most sense. I was kind of dreading, like, we might not be back till February or March. There was a little of that before this most recent news, and like, you know, I need something to do. Like, I'm kind of bored, man.
No, and I'm getting there. What I'll say is, for how I like to do my job and others around the league, like, if we're going to get back and everything's still going to be on Zoom calls and there's not going to be one-on-ones and stuff like that, like, I have no interest. I have interest, but it's like, that's not what's fun to me, is writing what 10 other, 12 other people are going to have the same quotes and stuff. The Pistons aren't really a team where you write about after every game. At least it doesn't appear to be that. And at where I work, I have the freedom to kind of craft my beat how I want. I don't always write off of games. It just doesn't seem like a great use of time for the team I cover. There's other ways to garner interest. And yeah, like I said, like, if we're going to get back and it's just going to be Zoom calls and the same five quotes being tossed around in 12 different stories, like, that doesn't excite me. I'm in the camp of, and it's selfish, I'd rather wait until things get back to normal, but it's not going to happen. They're not going to pause the world again for me. So it is what it is. I'm not as excited as I would be if we could get back and it'd be normal. If you could guarantee me we'd get back to how it was around Christmas time, yeah, let's go. I'm ready to go. I'd go tomorrow, but that's not going to be the case. And that kind of takes some of the joy out of returning, at least on my end.
Yeah, I mean, it does unquestionably make the job a little harder. I mean, it's just much more difficult to come up with original angles if you're not there and having those face-to-face conversations. I mean, it's just not as fun, and I think it definitely affects the quality of the work. But those are small potatoes in the grand scheme of things with everything that's going on. Let's talk about Stan's run in Detroit a little bit. You know, when this hire came down, like, my initial impression of his run at Detroit, well, I mean, obviously that was a failure. I mean, they only made the playoffs once in 4 years. And the more I dug into it, I mean, it definitely wasn't a success. I wouldn't call it that. But, you know, really kind of digging into it, I don't think it was as bad as I initially thought after doing a little research. You know, I think the main reason why I say that is, It was a rough situation when Stan got in there. Like, they were winning, you know, 25 or 30 games, like, the 5 years before that, the roster was pretty barren. You know, when you just look back at Stan's run, how do you kind of evaluate that as someone who's real close to it?
Yeah, I mean, and even though I didn't cover the majority of it, I lived in Michigan. I went to Michigan State. I watched the Pistons more than any other team. And what you just said is correct. Like, people act like Stan's tenure was like was when the world collapsed. No, Stan kind of cleaned up some of that and made the Pistons a respectable organization again. I mean, it wasn't that far removed from when he took over that there was like the boycott on John Kuster, where players weren't showing up to shoot-arounds, and it was a mess. And the team was really starting to fall further away from that kind of championship pedigree. Like, I mean, people might not know this because they don't really follow the Pistons, but I mean, I think your above average basketball fan would consider the Pistons one of the 10 best franchises in NBA history. I mean, they have three titles, three different decades. The most recent one, obviously, in 2004. And shortly after that, that group split up, things went south, and Stan came in. They really wanted him, which is obviously why they added on the team president title. They were competing with the Warriors. And he made them respectable. He brought in some really good guys. They fought. They weren't the most talented teams, obviously, but they had some moments. I think, I don't know if Stan probably thought that his tenure in Detroit would live and die with the health of Reggie Jackson, but it kind of did. When Reggie Jackson was healthy, the Pistons were a playoff team. When he wasn't, they weren't a playoff team. He made tough decisions. Yeah, waving Josh Smith ended up being on the Pistons' books until this is the first year that his $5 million isn't. But they were 5-28 or 5-23 or something the year that he started the season, and then they cut him and ended up with a decent record at 30-something wins. They rattled off a bunch of wins in a row. Yeah, Stan changed the culture back in Detroit. Dwayne Casey has now taken that and has continued to go a little bit further with that. I think that Stan's tenure in Detroit will be isn't going to be remembered as a fond one because of nothing. There was no success, but I would say that he did, from a culture standpoint, at least make the Pistons respectable. And I would say nobody would argue that he wasn't a good coach. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about some of the coaching stuff, but I mean, his downfall was really as team president, like signing guys like John Lue to big deals, poor drafting. So Pelican fans don't really have to worry about that from this standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, just to, you know, give listeners in New Orleans and Pels fans an idea of how bleak things were before Stan got to Detroit. In 2013-14, the season before he got there, they won 29 games. I was looking back at Basketball Reference this morning. Their four leading scorers on that team were Josh Smith, Brandon Jennings, Greg Monroe, and Rodney Stuckey. So, you know, Stan's run in Detroit, it might not have been successful, but
How many of those guys are still in the league?
That wasn't that long ago, and like just rattling off those names, that seems like ancient basketball history, right?
And all those guys, don't quote me, and we can look it up, but I think all those guys are under 32, and none of them are in the league. Josh Smith's the only one that I'm not sure if he's 32 still, but I know Jennings, Monroe, and Stuckey might be 32. But there are a lot of players in their age range that are still in the NBA. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, those teams were not good. They were in transition phases, and they didn't draft well before Stan got there. Aside from Andre Drummond, really. And he's no longer with the team. And it's just been – at the end of the day, you can point fingers at X, Y, Z, W, B, C, D, but, like, the team hasn't drafted well. And that's why they're in the predicament that they're in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everybody you talk to in the Pels organization has kind of, you know, made a point to say that the job Stan is, you know, taking over now is going to be much different than what he did in Detroit. I mean, I think we've kind of seen that, you know, being the president of basketball operations and the head coach, it's just too much on one guy's plate unless you're like Greg Popovich or something. I mean, it's just such a big job. It rarely works out. You know, everybody's, you know, pretty much made the point that Stan is just going to be the head coach here. And, you know, David Griffin and Trajan Langdon and Swin Cash, they're going to handle the front office side. So, you know, I think he's got a pretty good chance to be successful because he's just doing a job that he's already proven he can do well. You know, I think one of the big reasons why the Pelicans were attracted to Stan was the defense. You know, I wrote a piece that went up over the weekend. Stan has overseen 9 top 10 defenses in his 12 seasons. What do you think are just some specific beliefs that Stan Van Gundy has about playing defense?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think one thing is accountability. I just remember from my 1 year covering him, he was not afraid to call out the first guy on the roster and the 15th guy on the roster. Working hard, knowing where you're supposed to be is key. Knowing your personnel. I think he comes up with good schemes that, I mean, even in Detroit, I think they had one top 10 defense, maybe two. And those, I don't think anybody that, there wasn't too many good defenders on that team. And I think Stan has a good scheme of placing the big where he needs to be to help the guards. Andre Drummond was a fine pick and roll defender in terms of defending guards. I think accountability is huge. I think just in terms of schematics, again, he has a good plan and he can relay it well to people. It, at the end of the day, though, it just comes down to execution. And I don't think in Detroit he necessarily had the pieces to execute what he was trying to get across. But you saw it in Orlando, Miami, with some of the pieces that they did have. Obviously, Dwight Howard, one of the best defenders we've seen in a long time, and Miami just has that culture of just getting after it. And I mean, we could list the guys that they have that were good defenders as well. But yeah, his scheme demands a lot out of guys, but if you have the guys that are willing to do it, I think it works very well.
You know, a word you used, accountability, is one I've heard a lot over the past week or so. You know, the read I get is Stan is not going to be afraid. You know, if Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram, the two kind of cornerstones of what the Pelicans are building, if those guys aren't buying in or doing the right things on defense, like, I don't think he's going to be afraid to, like, you know, coach them up pretty hard. And I think that's, you know, a lot of coaches are hesitant to really coach the star players hard now. I mean, they just have so much power. I mean, I think Stan is confident enough in who he is. He's had so much success that he's just not going to be afraid to coach, you know, the best two guys on the roster as hard as, you know, the 14th or 15th guys or whatever.
No, I agree. And I think having J.J. Redick there is going to be huge because he's that liaison from Stan to the players, the young guys. The young guys, from everything I've read and watched, they respect J.J. and J.J. respects the hell out of Stan. And J.J. was in Orlando when Stan was there, and he's talked about on multiple occasions the struggles of his first few years and dealing with being the man at Duke and a first round pick and not playing much, and then kind of having that aha moment later in his career down the line that Stan really did have his best interest, and everything that kind of he went through the ringer early on, and it paid off. And I think that JJ is going to be able to kind of relay that if he's around. When guys like maybe Zion or Brandon feel like Stan is not doing too much, but being very maybe picking on them or whatever it is, and JJ can point to, like, it's gonna work. Like, trust me. Like, I know from firsthand experience. And Zion doesn't really strike me as a guy that would really complain too much about being coached hard. That's not the vibe I get from him. Ingram, I don't know, but I could maybe see it, especially on the defensive end. But yeah, I think Stan's in the right spot with the right veterans around him. You have, like I said, you have JJ. You have a guy like Jrue Holiday who already leads by example on that end. I think it's a good fit for Stan, as long as I think the big thing is learning how to deal with today's players is probably the one question I'm curious to see if he's answered with this time away, because I mean, I can remember like 2 or 3 hour shoot arounds before games and like 3 hour practices in the middle of March. I don't think you can really do that as much now today. But I think from a getting the best out of players, I think players respect Stan. Excuse me, players respect Stan, and I think once they get with him, they know he knows what he's talking about. So if he can kind of temper the player management, and I don't mean load management, like player management and those grueling days and sessions, I think it's going to work, as long, again, as everybody's willing to be accountable and buy in and do what they have to do individually to make the team defense work.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been doing this for that long, but it seems that's a pretty rare occurrence, a shoot around to last like, you know, hours, like multiple hours. That I've never really heard of that before.
Yeah, it was. I can just remember many times on the road and at home when we're kind of just looking at our clocks and like, alrighty, like it's 1 o'clock. Michigan State's playing Michigan in football. Like, we want to get back and watch the game, and Stan's still going. So I think from what I've gathered and talking to players, I think that part like was a little overboard. But I don't think, again, they all knew he had their best interest, because as I'm sure you've heard, like, Stan is meticulous and he's as prepared as any coaches there's been in the last 15 years, but it comes at a cost. And I'm curious to see. I'll have to check back in with you and Will to see if you guys are waiting around on Tuesday mornings in Atlanta before they play, and it's 1 o'clock and you guys are just now doing your interviews or something.
Yeah. I think it's gonna feel like a little bit of a change going from Alvin Gentry to Stan Van Gundy. I mean, it's, you know, two guys who've had success. I think it's just different styles. I would pay money to watch Stan Van Gundy like teach Jackson Hayes pick and roll defense. You know, Jackson is just he's just still kind of a kid. He's learning the game. Like, you know, I would throw down $100 to watch that for an hour. I think it'd be pretty entertaining. But you brought up, you know, JJ Redick, and him and Stan have worked together before in Orlando. JJ was going into his second year then, and you know, he's had such a fascinating career because he was, you know, this obviously just a huge deal at Duke, and it's just a much different thing for him in the NBA. He had to learn how to be kind of a star in his role. I mean, he's really been an excellent role player, and I think he feels that, you know, Stan helped him understand what it takes. I mean, he said that Stan pretty much taught me everything I know about team defense and just kind of forming and solidifying the habits that can help you, you know, last more than a decade in the NBA. I think JJ's going into year 15. I've heard that from a few guys. I talked to Rafer Alston, but, like, you know, I'm excited to see what Stan does with Zion and Brandon Ingram, obviously, but, like, I'm also excited to see what he does with, like, Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Jackson Hayes and the young guys who I think they have some talent, but they're just such unfinished players.
Yeah, and maybe that's some people's worry, because when you hear the name Stan, I think most people in our profession, maybe that aren't familiar, link it with Tom Thibodeau, and maybe it's not the best coach to have with young players. But I think Stan's a little different if the player is built a certain way. Like, I don't think Stan dislikes young players. I know that was kind of a notion in Detroit, but I think he likes having guys he can rely on. It's almost like you hear a football coach just talking about, I'm just going to, if I know where somebody, if they might mess up, but they know where they're supposed to be. And that's big, I think, big for Stan. And a lot of young players don't know where they're supposed to be. And as long as the player buys in, as long as the player shows a willingness to learn, and adapt and comprehend. Of course, the young player is going to make mistakes, but if they can comprehend, learn from them, just know where you're supposed to be, know what you're supposed to do, I think Stan will put you under his wing and the relationship will flourish from there. Like, I mean, you can look at Stanley Johnson in Detroit. The year they made the playoffs in 2016, they got 16 or 17, they got swept by 16, they got swept by the Cavs, but Stanley played a lot and he guarded LeBron. And that was a 19, 18-year-old rookie. Luke Kennard's career in Detroit, he didn't play until, like, the fourth or fifth game, but when he did, he got out there and was, like, 6 of 7 in his first couple games, and then he kept playing from there on out. And it's like, Stan, once you get the trust from Stan, I think Stan will let you ride. It's just, again, not making mistakes in terms of not knowing what you're supposed to do. I think that probably irks, I mean, not just Stan, but all coaches. Especially old school coaches like Dwayne can't stand when guys don't know where to be or what to do. Like, he can handle hustle mistakes and going too hard mistakes, but again, not when they do this type of preparation and you don't comprehend that. That's, I think, what irks these type of coaches the most.
Well, I mean, I guess there is, like, this idea that you just can't coach players as hard today as you did 10 years ago. And I think I mostly agree with that. But, like, why do you think that is? Like, why do you think the approach has changed so much?
I think because the player, and I like this and I'm all for it, because the league is a player-based league. I just think the players have so much control. And it's important to keep the player happy for these organizations like a New Orleans, like a Detroit, as you just went through with Anthony Davis. They try to keep him as happy as long as they can. And it's different. We're talking about, like, coaching specifics, but I mean, I even think it translates. Like, you have a small window when you're a small market to make these things work. And if you get a coach in there that pisses off your young star and he's going to be there for 4 years, which is, he's going to be there about the length of Zion's rookie deal. And obviously Zion's probably going to sign a second deal, but it's still, it's a players-based league more than ever. The players have more control. They have more say. The coaches aren't successful without these players. I just think there's just been a shift in who runs the league almost, if that makes any sense. And the players always ran the league because they were the best players, but I still think it's a little different because players have so much say and they can kind of dictate these franchises' destinies going forward if they're unhappy or happy.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, I just think basketball is unique because one really good player can affect winning and losing in a way that one really good player in baseball or soccer or football probably can. I mean, there's only 5 guys out there. So I think that's a pretty big part of it. You know, I guess Stan maybe has a reputation for like not always getting along with star players. And I don't necessarily think I think that. Like, I think he made it work for with Dwight for a long time. Like, I think, you know, they were on the same page for a while, and then, you know, after a while they were not. Shaq has, you know, kind of made some disparaging comments after the fact, but I think for the most part, like, he actually has gotten along with those high profile guys, even if there have been like a few dust ups, I guess. I mean, he had a ton of success with Dwight before, you know, it seemed like Dwight just kind of got tired of it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with you saying that you don't agree. Like, I mean, you don't hear Dwayne Wade utter a bad word about Stan.
Yeah.
You don't hear J.J. Redick utter a bad word about Stan. Andre and Stan had, like, their dust-ups, but Andre respected the hell out of Stan. I think more so it was just, like, a young guy being told that he had to be held accountable for his job. And, like, I don't think there was ever any, like, serious beef there or anything ever. Like, I think there was a good working relationship. And I think there was a respect for one another. Like, yeah, I think, again, it all comes down to accountability. Stan's not going to be afraid to tell you what he thinks. And if you're one of those people that maybe have a certain view of yourself or have never really been told about yourself, for lack of a better term, like, Stan could rub you the wrong way. And I would want that in a coach if I was a star player, role player, eighth man, 12th man, G League guy. But not everybody's built the same.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Orlando run a little bit. Stan, you know, gets a lot of credit for kind of being ahead of his time with that Magic team. They were near the bottom in 3-point attempts per game before he took over. And then I think every one of his years there, they were in the top two. You know, I think Stan is like progressive as a tactician in some ways. Like, his teams have always forced a lot of mid-range shots, even dating back to the Heat days. You know, I think he obviously realizes like the value of the three, but the sense I get and listen to a bunch of interviews with him is like he's pretty flexible. He's gonna play different ways based on what his roster looks like. And I mean, you know, and in Orlando it was like, okay, we're going four shooters around Dwight, but like Detroit, you know, it seemed like he felt like his pathway to success was like, we can kind of make it work with our two bigs, right?
Yeah, I would say in Orlando, and I feel like I'd heard him talk about it before he said it to us or somebody told me, like, in Orlando, like, he stumbled into that because I think somebody got hurt and he had to play Rashard at the four.
Yeah, it was Tony Batty. Yeah. They signed him to be their power forward.
That's right, yeah, hurt. Tony Batty. So they stumbled into that and it worked, and he stuck with it and built this offense that see is revolutionary. And then I would say in Detroit, what it was is he was very heavy on the pick and roll. Like, he went and got Reggie Jackson. He had Andre Drummond. And if I'm not mistaken, that year they made the playoffs in 2016, that was the best pick and roll tandem in the league, I believe. If not, they were top five. And that was kind of the way that the game was going at that time, was the pick and roll with your big. And obviously evolutioned into bigs to stretch the floor in the middle of that process, but the framework was there. So I think Stan has always kind of had one eye on what's working offensively around the league. And even if you stumbled into something, seeing that it did work and using that to his advantage is the sign of a good coach when you talk about the Orlando situation. But in Detroit, I would say he had a plan to run the pick and roll, spread it out. I think it was more two bigs out of necessity, because I'm trying to remember that year. I think it was Tobias was the four. And John Luer started at the four for a little, maybe the second half. I can't remember which season was which, but Luer and Harris were both the four. But, I mean, Luer was a guy that was supposed to be a stretch four. He just couldn't make any threes when he was in Detroit. And Tobias obviously developed as a really good three-point shooter. So I think Stan, while he's known for his defense, has come up with some worthwhile offensive schemes. Because, I mean, in Detroit, there was nobody there during his tenure that you would kind of call a bucket getter. Like, they were guys that needed other guys to get their offense. Like, Tobias isn't – I would like to see – I'd have to go back and look. Like, Tobias's numbers with and without Reggie Jackson, like, he's not a guy that's going to create for himself. And Reggie Jackson is not a guy that's as efficient without a big to work in the pick and roll. So it was two different styles, but I think they both were kind of, one set the tone for what was to come and the other followed the wave of what was going on. It was just, as it progressed, the evolution really wasn't there. And that could come down to two roster decisions, having to kind of work with Andre Drummond for all those years because he was under contract. The owner really liked him, wanted him around. So you don't know what really goes into all of that. But it was a, I would say Stan offensively doesn't get as much credit as I think he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious to see what the Pelicans do at center this offseason. I think that's going to kind of tell us a lot about the way they want to play. You know, Derek Favors is an unrestricted free agent. I don't think that Jackson Hayes is ready to become the full-time starting center. And, you know, I think if you signed a center like, I don't know, a Myers Leonard or, you know, somebody... so.
I, like, yeah, he'd Christian be a perfect would. Foot. He'd be a perfect fit.
He would.
And I'm sure you know this, and I think you were in the scrum when I did that story on Christian. I asked Alvin, if I'm not mistaken, Christian only got cut because they needed the money to sign JJ or the roster spot or something. So they liked him. It was just a matter of trying to get JJ in there. I have a fake Pelicans trade that I threw out with Sam Vecenie that I think there's a player that's obtainable that would work. I like Miles Turner there.
I'm actually, I don't know. I think Miles Turner is like not as good. Like if I don't know, I'm not that much of a Miles Turner fan. I mean, he looks better than he actually is, I think.
No, I don't think Miles Turner is what Miles Turner is, but I think if you're going to pair a center with Zion, Miles is kind of the one, a guy that can stretch the floor, a good rim protector, fits the timeline of the roster. I like that one. Tell just text David Griffin if you can, just Miles Turner question.
the fake one that I've been like just texting friends is figure out a way to get Zach Collins from Portland.
Okay.
I don't think they'd be able to, because I think Nurk's deal is up after this year and they probably run him around for insurance. But like, yeah, that kind of guy, like younger, can protect the rim, can shoot a jump shot. The guy ideally you'd like to put next to Zion. What do you think Christian Wood's market is going to be?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. Like, I know that there are teams in line, teams with cap space, teams without cap space that want him. I think a team like Charlotte's going to. So if Detroit gets him for the average annual value, which is about $10 million, he'll only count like 1.7 against their books. I think a team like Charlotte's going to come in and at least offer like 12, 13, forcing Detroit to go 14, 15. And there's risk, obviously, because he's only had 3/4 of a good season in his career. And he was good those last 17 games in New Orleans. But I mean, again, the team wasn't making the playoffs. It was a lot of just kind of throwing rosters out there to get through the year. But he was really good in Detroit, and I get the hesitation because he just hasn't been around long enough. But, I mean, man, today's NBA for bigs is built for Christian Wood. And if you're a believer in him and those skills, and he's going to continue to get better even with him finally getting a payday, I think $15 million is a steal.
It's crazy how quickly life got better for Christian Wood.
Yeah. I mean, just like that.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. What do you think the Pistons are going to do at 7 this year?
Oh, man. I think they go. I'm all. When you're in a position like Detroit, when you just need talent, like, I'm still all for just getting the best player available. But I still think at 7, the best player available is going to fit a need, which is point guard. So I think it's going to be Halliburton or Hayes. I think RJ Hampton could slip in there. I think they're going to go guard. Okongwu from USC is another guy that I think is a dark horse for the Pistons. I'm curious too, because there's a new front office here, so I'm not as familiar with their thinking. Obviously, I've met Troy and got a chance to talk to him, but they keep kind of stuff close to the chest. So. And this year's just been weird in general. And, yeah, so I'm kind of curious to see what they do as well. I wouldn't be surprised if they traded it. I wouldn't be surprised if they moved up, moved back. Yeah, I could go several different ways, especially if there's not going to be fans in the stands. Like if Detroit really wants to rebuild, this year might be the year to do it again. If you're not going to have anybody in the stands anyway.
I am by no means a draft guy, trademark, but I really like Halliburton and I really like Okongwu. Okongwu, a former high school teammate of Lonzo Ball.
That's right.
Yeah, I did a story on that Chino Hills team. They went like 35-0 and were like, ranked number one nationally, even though you really can't tell who the best high school team in the nation is. But that team was loaded. It was
Yeah.
all three Ball brothers, Okongwu, and then this dude, Eli Scott, who's got a chance to like be in the league in 2 years. He's going back to college for one more year,
Okay.
but I would not have wanted to face them.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I would not have wanted to either, especially if the Ball brothers were shooting from 45 feet and knocking them down. It doesn't sound like fun.
What are the chances that Okongwu is the best NBA player out of everybody on that high school team?
From what I've watched and studied up on and people I've talked to, like I think it's high. Like he's an undersized center, but I mean many people believed he was one of the best interior defenders in all of college basketball last year. I think he has nice touch around the rim. He doesn't have a jump shot yet, but I mean if he can develop that only opens up his game. I just think he's a low maintenance, good defender. Low maintenance offensively, good defender, good in the pick and roll defending. Yeah, like I like what he brings in terms of where the NBA is going with front court players. I wouldn't be surprised if he's playing the biggest role on the best team down the line. Yeah, and whether or not that equates to him being the best player from this draft, I don't know, but I think he could be playing meaningful minutes on a really good team at some point in his career.
I think we were both on that call with LaMelo Ball. I mean, there was like close to 100 media members
Yeah.
for his pre-draft or combine availability. I would best describe LaMelo Ball's energy as like TikTok star. Like he kind of like reminds me of like one of those kids who's in like the hype house or something. Do you think
Yeah.
that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. Yeah, that was a interesting Zoom call. I tuned out halfway through once somebody asked him what music he's been listening to. I'm not a fan.
A lot of tough questions on
Oh
those
my
things.
gosh, like that, some of that stuff I can only stomach for so long when it comes to draft interviews. Yeah, like it was very short. He's confident in his game. I don't know him well enough to say cocky, but it's like very confident and he's just short with his answers. I don't know the personality. I don't know if there's much of a personality there. See, does Lonzo have a good personality or is he kind of just a basketball, like I know he plays video games and stuff, but like how's his like personality if you just wanted to go talk to him at a shooter on?
He is all business all the time with the media, like, short, straightforward answers. Like he's never gonna make a mistake. Like he'll be pretty honest sometimes. But yeah, he keeps it short. But I actually think he does have a personality behind the scenes. Like he actually seems like a pretty funny dude when he's just hanging out with his friends. I mean, of course, I'm just going on like what I see on like Instagram stories and stuff.
Right.
But yeah.
I mean, I guess there's personality when you're with your friends, but like even just having a conversation, and again, LaMelo's situation was 100 people over Zoom asking him if they worked out for his team, the teams they cover. But like even like at a shoot-around setting, like being able to just go up to a guy and not even ask him about basketball, just like what, if you wanted to ask somebody at a shoot-around, like what are you listening to or like stuff, what are you reading? Like, are they going to give you short answers? Are they going to like engage with you? Like, I think that's a real tell of somebody's personality. Like, a person that like these guys get to know us. Like, we're around them as much as their family. So, if they still, even with the cameras off and the microphones off, and they can't hold a conversation, like that rubs me the wrong way. And I'm curious how. I've never obviously covered a Ball brother, but they seem like nice kids. All like when the cameras are off. And they seem like nice guys with the cameras on. It just seems like they're a little too media trained.
Yeah, it's been weird. They've been in the public eye and they've all been famous since they were teenagers, so it's just a really weird deal. I'm really curious to see what happens with Lonzo this offseason. I think he's probably the most likely to get traded of anyone on the roster. I would actually say that he's probably more likely to get traded than Jrue Holiday. He also switched his representation. He's with Clutch now, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Like, I think David Griffin, you know, has like good relationships with Rich Paul, but you know, Clutch just has a reputation for, we're gonna try to get the most, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So if he wants to get paid, he did the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They've gotten KCP.
So, I don't know.
Paid.
I wouldn't want to have to make. Yeah, yeah. Well, you got a little taste of KCP before he left, right?
No, his last year in Detroit was I came the next year. So like, Avery Bradley came in my first year. Who else? They did the Avery Bradley for Marcus Morris deal the summer before the season started, which was my first season. So I missed KCP by a few months.
Oh yeah, he signed with the Lakers and he was mana from heaven, right?
Yeah.
That's what Rob Pelinka said.
Yeah, I forgot about that. He did say that. And I think he turned down a 5-year, $80 million deal from the Pistons, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 4 years. And yeah, I don't know who, I think Detroit won that, like, or lucky. Like, I don't know. Like, he signed a 12-year deal, 13-year deal, like these 1-year deals where he's like slowly getting back to that $80 million. But like, I don't know if he'll get there. But he had a good final showing. I'm curious to see if in the long haul him turning down that money works out for him. But he did get a ring out of it. So, and I mean, $12 million is a lot of money. So in one season.
Yeah, it's working out okay for KCP.
Yeah,
it looks
like
he's having
fine.
Some fun. He's pretty good. I mean, he played really well in the finals, so I was impressed.
Yeah, and I think there's always been kind of links to him in Atlanta where he's from, and like this summer could be interesting if he got his ring. Maybe Atlanta needs a guy like him. Like I'm very interested to see how much Atlanta would pony up for KCP.
Yeah, I mean, if I was in the business of representing players, once they got that ring, I'd say go get that bag, young man. I mean, it's once you win a little bit, like go get paid. I mean, that's what I would be advising them.
I agree. We're in the same boat.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it, and I do feel like I learned a lot about staying time in Detroit. I think it's gonna be really fun down here. I mean, there's always a lot of optimism, you know, with new beginnings, but I think it was a really good hire, and the Pels front office did good.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me, and always look forward to seeing you when the Pelicans and Pistons play, and I always read your stuff. And yeah, I think Stan, when I saw that and I saw his name pop up even before he was hired, like I thought that was a good fit. And I think he waited out for the right job. It's an interesting team that's not right on, it's not going to contend for a title anytime soon, and it's not a bad team, and if they work, they could get in position to be a pretty good team. There's good mix of young and new, the perfect mix, I think, in Stan's case, because of JJ and Jrue being there and kind of setting the tone in terms of his principles, and also kind of being a liaison, especially in JJ's case. And just from a personality standpoint, I think you're going to enjoy Stan. He's going to be honest. If you do notebooks, but he's going to fill your notebook every day with an array of topics, from the NCAA, what he thinks about them, and to schematics and all that stuff, and obviously political views. And yeah, he's a good dude. I didn't get to know him as well as others on the beat because, again, it was only 1 year, and they were around from those other, Vince and Rod were around his entire time, and so there was always kind of like a filling out period early on, but I thought once we got to the end there was a pretty good relationship. But yeah, like he's a guy that I always compare it like this. Like, if you go to the bar and maybe you just broke up with your girlfriend and you have your suit and tie on after work, and you're just going to the bar and you sit there by yourself, and there's this guy next to you, just starts a conversation with you, that's Stan. Like, you're gonna be engaged, you're gonna be interested, you're gonna walk away feeling like you learned something. You had a good time, a good chat. Like, Stan's that guy at the bar that's like gonna entertain you for the next few hours, because he's just a down to earth guy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want as a beat writer. I'm really looking forward to it. You guys can read James's stuff on The Athletic. If you don't have a subscription, go and get one. It's worth the money. I read The Athletic every day. Appreciate you guys for listening. Like and subscribe. It helps out a lot. And we'll talk to you next week.